find out what it's like to experience the world from above. Fly your own drone today. DroneCloneExperts.com specializes in high-quality, affordable drones. Now introducing their Limitless 2 model, equipped with a 4K camera for stunning Ultra HD clarity, GPS with precision auto return, and up to 25 minutes flight time on a single charge. Visit DroneCloneExperts.com now and enter promo code RADIO to receive 15% off your entire order. That's DroneCloneExperts.com.
Hello, Verbal Shenanigans fans. We're excited to welcome a new sponsor to the show. So listen on up. We're embarking on a new year, and that means new sponsors. Since we know many of you are sports fans, you are going to love this. Our newest sponsor of the show is DynastySportsEmpire.com. Say it one more time, DynastySportsEmpire.com. Otherwise known as DSE, they are the world's largest dynasty and keeper fantasy league management company in the world. We're not talking about your cute little home league with Uncle Reno or Draft Queens or FanDouche or one of those other companies. This is real fantasy general managing at its core. If you're tired of your mundane redraft league and have always wanted to retain your amazing team year in, year out, then DSE is where you want to be. They got fantasy hockey and hoops leagues now forming, so visit DynastySportsEmpire.com and see if you have what it takes to conquer their fantasy leagues today. That's DynastySportsEmpire.com. And again, we're very happy to welcome them to the Verbal Shenanigans family. We got a great episode for you today. Go check out DynastySportsEmpire.com.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, everybody. Welcome on back to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Hello, Michael. Merry Christmas or post-Christmas, last episode of the year. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Holiday season wrapping up. Got one more week to handle. Working on New Year's Eve, which is weird to me. I don't understand why that's not also a holiday, but we just roll with the punches, you know?
I guess this year of any year is like fine to work on New Year's Eve, because what the hell is anybody doing on New Year's Eve this year?
It's not a principle of like caring. It's just more to, it's what I always say. The holiday is really the eve. I understand you get off the day after because that's the recovery day. But like if you're getting ready a normal year to go out and party and drink and whatever.
Yeah.
That work day is just everybody saying how blasted they're going to get that night, or I'm not even going to make it till 11 o'clock before I go to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. I think we need to celebrate more eves as a country. We need eves for all the major holidays that we should have off also.
Martin Luther King Eve would be pretty rocking.
MLK Eve, right? Halloween Eve is already kind of mischief night. We don't get off for that.
There you go.
Memorial Day Eve could be like the Friday before.
Give me Thanksgiving Eve, so I have just a two-day work week.
Exactly.
And pretty much you half-ass that day anyway, so it's like one and a half.
And let's face it, usually the eve is like the most exciting part. Like Christmas Eve for me growing up was always like Christmas was always fun, but Christmas Eve was like the thing I looked forward to most, because it's like when all my family got together.
That's when like the cousins and everybody gets together just to do like the pre-Christmas kind of thing. Like, all right, this ain't your big gift, but you got to get in the festive.
Yeah, it's like the start of the next couple days are going to be cool. Like the eve is here. Thanksgiving Eve was always pretty cool because it was always like a night that everybody would go out. I used to have turkey fry parties on Thanksgiving Eve where people would bring over their turkeys and we'd deep fry them. And then you'd bring over whatever else you wanted to deep fry after that. So people would try anything, mozzarella sticks and sweet potato fries. And that was always a fun thing to listen to. So I think we need to implement more eves.
So I think instead of E's, we should just have days where we just fry stuff for the hell of it.
Friday.
Yeah. And just like really just go out. Just like, hey, I got a mattress I can't get rid of. We'll throw it in the deep fryer. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. What about just like one day a year where you eat as unhealthy as possible? Like the goal is to just put as many, we'll call it calorie day. Like you just have to gorge on food.
Yeah, like your workout, like coaches or whatever, just like, all right, you know, we're going to take it easy today because we know what you're doing tomorrow.
Right.
But just prepare for Monday. I'm going to get right back at you. So this is your rest area right here. Get what you need. Come back when you're ready.
Like we know calorie day is coming. So we're really going to crush you guys today because calorie, I mean, I know we have Thanksgiving, but what if we like really Americanized it and just made deep fried and sugar coated and I don't know what else would be donuts and just everything is as awful as possible.
Yeah. I mean, the goal should be like diabetes.
Right. Exactly.
That's the only goal. It's like, no, bro, blood sugar too low, man. Got to go in for another pie.
Yeah, like you celebrate by like if you can get to the hospital by like 6 p.m., you win calorie day in your family.
Yeah. Oh, Uncle Jethro won. He lost a leg this year. Good for him. Jethro, he was not giving up this year.
And you know, instead of like athletic sports on TV, we'll put like, there'll be like nothing but like bowling, pool, all these like very still kind of sports.
Cornhole.
Exactly. Calorie day cornhole tournament. It's perfect.
Dear God, that's, can we somehow like incorporate that? Like when everything goes down and like the world is back to normal, we got to figure out a way to have the verbal shenanigans calorie cornhole day.
Yeah, calorie day.
And just like dominate it. There's zero possibility somebody leaves that party with no fun.
Like what?
Even us can't screw it up.
Listen, everybody hates America, right? We pretty much hate it everywhere at this point.
I would say about 98% of the country do, yeah.
So why not? I mean, half of America hates America right now. Like, it's like cool to hate America now. So if we double down and make the most American holiday possible, like F4th of July, calorie day, like, you know, we don't care about the starving countries. We are just embracing the most amount of food you can put into your body.
Yeah, I feel we should have those send like 27 cents and you can feed a family, have it like on a loop as we're eating like double deep fried turkey legs.
Double down in some ways. Yeah, make it really hurt.
Like you put the turkey into a fryer and then you pick up the fryer and then we have like a mega fryer that you throw the fryer into the fryer.
So you're dropping individual fryers into a bigger deep fryer.
Yeah, this is going to be kind of an expensive ordeal, but I think it'll be worth it in the end.
For calorie day, it's worth it because you'll have that fryer for life. Well, I mean, life might not be that long. So you have to make sure that you, when you celebrate calorie day, you write who the fryer is going to in the family. In the sudden absence of you, a sudden passing.
And we're going to get protesters there. There's going to be people with picket signs talk about eat more carrots. But, you know, we're going to take care of them. We're going to deep fry some rocks and then chuck it at them.
Yeah, I mean, everything. We're going to take turkeys and stick them in donut dough and then take that and shove it in a deep fried, I don't know, what's a bigger bird than a turkey?
Ostrich.
Yeah, shove it in a deep fried ostrich and then put frosting on the top. It's going to get really weird and disgusting.
Can we eat a giraffe? Can we look at that? Is that still possible nowadays?
I mean, I feel like you're allowed to kill a giraffe if it's feeding a lot of people. Because one giraffe can feed a lot of people.
One giraffe for calorie day, I feel, will just make things work. And then we got to get somebody that's like a partial Native American in the Alaska culture because they're allowed to hunt for a whale once a year.
Right.
So then we're just going to have like a big old 18-wheeler come up on calorie day with a huge Shamu kind of blue rail.
Right.
And I don't, we'll just take every ounce of food that's remaining, shove it into the whale, and then shove that whale into the ocean deep fryer.
Right. Shove the giraffe, which is loaded with the turkey, and the ostrich into the whale and then frost that baby in calorie day. You know how, like, the president's supposed to pardon a turkey every year? Instead, we'd go the opposite way, and we pick a very endangered, very old giraffe and a very a very prime, preferably a pregnant whale.
Double down, gotcha.
And it's kind of going, it's already stuffed with another whale. So it's really, it's really at least two whales.
Yeah, we actually made two layers with one animal, which is great. And I like your point. I think Joe Biden should be at the White House and have a giraffe in an electric chair and just pull that trigger. And it's like, calorie day begins. And then we go at it.
Exactly. Well, okay. Welcome to the
show. That was some intro.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to the show, everybody. This is wrapping up 2020, which has been a phenomenal year here at the podcast. And next week, we're really going to break that down and go over our yearly awards, if you will, and kind of recap some of our favorite guests, our unexpected guests, the best female interviews, best science interviews. We always have a good time with that. So next week is going to be a pretty large recap episode. So if you're just tuning in and you like what you hear, next week's a great one because you get to hear all the ones that you missed and go back. So if you enjoy Calorie Day and you enjoy the podcast, this is the one for you. So
absolutely.
Mike, I want to thank you for your I got your gift on, I think it was like the day before Christmas. I think it was Christmas Eve, speaking of that. Now I see Michael Burl. I knew something was coming because you had asked me for my address. I see Michael Burl.
Before you continue, I've asked for it four times and I finally got around to it. To give you an idea, that was supposed to be shipped out after Lil Shay was born, to give you a rough idea, or even before Shay was born.
Right. So
a little tap on the back for being just 2 months late.
That's really actually good for you, judging by like all the Mother's Day cards you've never sent and Father's Day gifts you still have. Like 2 months is like probably in your top 10%.
Yeah, that's like actually caring, for lack of a better term, I believe.
Yes. 'Cause
2 months late is like, aw, he's so sweet.
Right. Like I was expecting maybe Shay's like sweet, 16th birthday or something like that. Like like this baby gift to roll up to the door.
Mary Lou, why'd you give him a diaper cake?
Now, very generous gift. Very nice gift. There was a baby Yoda in there, which my dog thought it was his immediately. So that was fun. Aww. Chasing him around the house with the baby Yoda in his mouth.
No. Obi, that's the child. No.
But it was so Berlew-esque. It was, you know, there's a gift card in there, but it was in a plastic bag. It looked like directly from the grocery store, dropped into the box and then like ship it. And the best part was that there was like a Kroger's, which is like the food store down by you, just receipt. So I saw like you guys bought shrimp.
Okay. Because like at first I thought you were busting me because I put the receipt for the gift card in there. At first I'm like, cute, whatever.
No.
Well, I apparently let you know what I had for Christmas dinner.
Oh, yeah. I put it somewhere. I should have got it for the show, but it was, I'm like, oh, he gifted us his shopping list. Also, you guys had shrimp on there. I think there was a loaf of bread. I'm like, wow, thanks, Mike. It was the perfect Berlew gift because it was like, it was very nice and generous, but it was also in a plastic bag with a receipt from another store. It was heartwarming.
Yes, again, to add to the, I don't really plan these things well, like literally like during the week, it's like, yeah, I'll get to the post office. And then it was sort of like, damn, I got to get it done now.
Yeah.
So I purposely made sure I ran around the house to make sure I got everything I want. I had to look for the pumpkin book.
Oh, the pumpkin book too. Yes.
There. Yep. So I had to search through there and found it in the ottoman. But just to make extra sure, I'm like, I know what I do. I'll figure this out, and then I'll be at the post office, and then I'll look into there, and I'll be like, damn it, forgot this.
Right.
So I just said, all right, shoving everything in the bag.
Loved it.
then I got to the post office, and of course, since it's we going into Christmas, a mile long line, I'm like, all right, I can't play around trying to put everything individually into the envelope. Wham! Put the whole bag in there.
Yeah,
as I put it in there, the lady's like, you put the label on there and there's no tape. I'm going to have to take this off to put on the tape. So,
yeah, it reminded me of you. And Shay was very happy with his present. So it's funny, the Baby Yoda thing, it was funny because we just sat down and finally, like, we've been putting it off for months. We just started The Mandalorian, because it's a little hard to watch a show with like a 2-month-old, you know, a lot of interruptions. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's not even worth starting anything new, because it's like, pause, baby's got to be changed, pause, baby's crying, and just kind of sucks you out of the moment. But
you got to explain to the baby who Boba Fett is.
Yes, yes. And the wife, you know, you got to. the show is. Like, I know you watched the whole thing, right? We're like...
Yep, we've gone through seasons 1 and 2 already, yeah. Yep.
So we're like, I think we're on episode 9, so we're almost through season 1.
All right.
Dig the show, visually it's really cool. It's just cool to kind of be in that universe and, you know, a show. And I do have some issues with it, though. Like, I find almost every episode is the same exact formula. It's like, okay... We're going on a mission. I don't like this mission that much. Okay, I gotta bring the child with me. Let's hide the child. Oh, crap. Someone's got the child. Or the child's in danger. Oh, crap. The mission's failing. Okay, random guy comes and rescues us. Or child, we accept the bounty. Get on space. Play cool music. Get on spaceship. And it's like a video game. Like, each episode felt like kind of like a level in a game. Like, okay, who are we fighting this week? It kind of reminded me of, like, remember the movie 300?
I know of it. Oddly, I never saw the whole thing.
Really? So it's like another movie. Like, I enjoy it, but, like, watching it back now, I'm like, it's kind of just like a video game. They're like, okay, who are the Spartans going to fight now? And then, like, a new force comes, and then a new force comes, and new monsters come, and they just keep winning. But, I'm hoping it's going to turn direction a little, at least, like, get some more story going. Because it kind of seems like, okay, I get it. Like, he has a child, fights someone off, moves on to the next place.
Well, with no spoilers, going to season 2, there's going to be more in the lore of the original Star Wars trilogy. Some things in there I won't involved there. So that'll be good. As for, like, the concept, I mean... I get what you're saying, but I think with, like, most kind of shows that, like, are in a specific theme universe, I'm not sure how off you can really go to keep the people in line. It's kind of like the original days of Walking Dead. You're like, all right, this season we're fighting these people. The next season, oh, now we're fighting these people and the zombies. Oh, now we're fighting these people and the zombies. And I can understand the repetition, but at the same point, I mean... I don't know where you could really go, because if you just go, I'm going to talk about this and then I'm going to table it for 3 episodes from now.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're going to really gain people in, and it's kind of a small cast. So it's not like, all right, I'm going to be on the sidelines here, Mandalorian, and then you go out and do something.
Yeah. It's not that I dislike it, because I definitely like it. I definitely watch all the way through. It's just, I'm finding it a little like, okay, I need I know what he does. I know his, I know his story now. Like, I need him to, like, some plot points to start to pop up, you know, like, it can't just be a mission every time, getting the bounty, kid's fine, the kid saves us with the force, he gets beat up really bad, but figures it out, and we'll shoot our way out of it. We're cornered again, and then it's like, let's shoot out of it. Okay, we won again. Now, I love seeing all the kind of Star Wars things that are great for fanfare, like all the animals and planets that we know of and things like that. But some of it, I'm like, okay, let's hit the gas pedal a little bit here. Like, I think we've told him, we get that he's this amazing warrior. We get that he was, you know, he was an orphan or whatever. And we get that the child knows the Force. Let's start to move a little bit.
Yeah, I would say the final two episodes kind of advance the thing and then sets up the next season. Then the next season, you get a little more myth lore with, like I said, with the original trilogies. You got to have it's a little more exciting, you know, certain parts of like the Star Wars, not just like the movies, but also like the cartoons and what that.
Right.
To like get super crazy, but it's still a good show. I mean, I don't follow like the cartoons or whatever. Like my wife just, it's funny. It went from while I was dating her, I took her to see Rogue One and she fell asleep during the movie, to now her telling me like random fact number 4,632 and then be happy that I don't know it and she does.
Yeah. I got that. I was actually talking with your wife through text message. You know, we're sending back and forth with, I said thank you for the gift, and we got on Star Wars somehow. My one worry about all of this, with all these shows, I think they said they had like 10 Star Wars shows or something coming out, like Disney's plan. I am worried where it gets so watered down that no one cares anymore. That's the one thing I do get. Like, you know, you mentioned The Walking Dead. Like, I couldn't even get into, what was the other one? Fear the Walking Dead?
Fear the Walking Dead.
And that came out when Walking Dead was still pretty good. And I was interested in it. I still was like, oh, I don't know if I could do another show. So this one's cool because it's like the first Star Wars show, right? But now we've had, you know, we got movies coming out. We've had Solo and Rogue One, and we got a bunch of other ones coming out. And I get worried that there's going to be like 10 shows, and it's going to be like, I don't care about this character. Like, they really, it's going to be a real big challenge to keep them all unique, but also like in the lore at the same time.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to kind of do what Marvel is doing, where they're thinking like outside the box of certain movies, like the next Doctor Strange is supposed to be like a horror movie, and they go with different themes and different tempos and different storylines. I think if you keep on mixing up, there's going to be like the like 3% who can handle every single thing they throw out there. But yeah. I think as long as you get two or three shows that people are intrigued with and keeps them coming to your platform, which is basically the goal,
right,
of what Disney's doing, that's all you really need. I mean, you throw 10 shows out there and four of them are bombs, that still means you got six shows that are making you money.
True. Yeah. And like, I even with the Marvel stuff, like I was actually happy that there's been kind of a little superhero break, you know, for the, I don't know how many months it's been since the last one came out, but even with things getting pushed back a little bit, I'm kind of like, okay. Like, it was like everything leading up to Avengers Endgame was like, blah, 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 blah. And then Spider-Man came out. I'm like, oh my God, this is a lot of, this is a lot of superhero stuff. And like, after a while, it's like, okay. Like, I don't, and like, even I see like the movies coming out for then, I'm like, Falcon and Winter Soldier. Like, I don't know. It's like, let's just take two guys and throw them in a movie and see what happens. Like, am I invested in those characters enough to care? That's kind of what I'm thinking. I'll watch it.
That's what it boils down to. I mean, I forget the name of the one. It's like a samurai movie. I don't even want to guess it because I know if I guess it, it'll come off almost.
You probably should.
No. I feel that will come back to haunt me if I attempt to guess the name of that movie.
Uh-huh.
But it's one that was supposed to come out in February.
Right.
So I think what Disney's doing right now is they're saying we're playing with our own money right now.
Yeah.
We know, it's kind of like when they made Guardians, as much as everybody loves Guardians and some people are like, yeah, I knew the Guardians, 95% of us was like, what the hell is this?
I had only heard the name, didn't know anything about it.
And that's what they're doing right now. They're just saying, since they got that thing with like all the crap with like Spider-Man's under Universal and they had to play with that,
yeah,
and the Hulk is under Sony, all the weird rules, that's when they can go, all right, let's look through the back catalog. You think we can make a movie out of this? All right, let's give it a shot.
Yeah.
What's the worst that can happen? They're like, we'll throw them away, and then like when we have Avengers 5, we'll let them come over for a cameo.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing for them too is going to be, now that we're losing like the main characters that everybody knows, they're the household names, Captain America, Iron Man, we all know them.
Like, dude, spoilers.
sorry, guys. I spoiled Endgame for you there. You had 3 years or whatever the hell it's been.
We had 3 years and it was the number one movie. But come on, bro. I'm busy.
But now are people going to be invested in these characters? You know, I call them like the B and the C characters. Like, and how are they going to keep that universe going where, you know, what was the whole Marvel, like, how many years was that? Like 13 years or something like that from the beginning? It was a long, long run.
Yeah, it was like early 2000s when Iron Man came out. And for the record, Shang-Chi and the Legends of the Ten Rings.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would have liked to hear what you would call it. Samurai and the Funky Bunch.
Semi-oriental person performing acrobatic ninja things.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But
it was Underdog, my bad.
But I'm all, like, questioning myself. Like, now that I see all those releases coming up, I'm like, I don't know a lot of these at all. Like, at all. Like, I knew Doctor Strange. I didn't know a ton about him. It ended up being probably my top three in that whole... And all of them. Like, I really love that movie. I thought it was very different than all the others. So,
and that's what Disney's got to bank on. It's like, all right, I'm going to make 10 things with Marvel, 10 things with Star Wars, but you all better be different. Don't look at what that guy's doing. Don't look at what that girl's doing. You do your own thing. If it's good, great. We'll probably ask for another one. If not, nice try. Come back in a couple years. We'll try it again.
Speaking of, I rewatched Endgame. Good movie, but I'm still depressed about Emo Hulk. It just really, he's my favorite character, and they built this in, like, how many movies? Like, three or four movies like that. He just lost his Hulkness, you know? And then I was just waiting for, you know, that moment in that big battle scene where we were going to get...
He just goes...
and we're just seeing the epicness of this 13-year run with the Hulk or whatever. But I didn't like the controlled Hulk that much. And... Yeah. I loved the Hulk so much in the Avengers first two movies. They did him so well, you know, with how they used him. So I was a little depressed about that.
Yeah, it still boils down to, since his film rights are under certain, I forget which one, and they bought Sony. I forget who owns it, but they didn't want to make him like his regular character. Where it's awesome, where they had the rights and they go, oh, okay, free movie.
Yeah, but
a deal.
How bad did you want to see a Hulk versus Thanos segment? You know, like, just like a 5-minute battle, you know, the two of them going crazy on each other.
Yeah, it would have been nice if I had the rematch, because they had like that 2 minutes at the first part of the movie, and then there was a whole confusion of, is he going to come back or whatever. I mean, it was anticlimactic, but I mean,
great movie, but just like my one thing that I really was like, ugh. Especially when that's like, that's like my favorite character of them all. I thought they did him so well.
Maybe you should send an email to Kevin Feige. Be like, listen,
you think so?
I know you made $3 billion on that movie, but that still perturbs me. That's why I'm giving it a 3.5 out of 5 stars.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll sit back and go, hire this Brennan guy.
Speaking real quick, yesterday, I'm like, you're watching The Mandalorian. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm like, babe, John Favreau did this too. Because just like recently, I was talking about all the random things he did. And she goes, oh, cool, the football guy? And I'm like, the football guy? And then I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, are you talking about Brett Favre? And she's like, oh, shit. I'm like... I'm like, did you just in your head like accept that Brett Favre just like retired from football and was like, you know, these Wrangler commercials aren't quite, you know, bringing in the money.
They're not as artistic as I want it to be. Let me try the movie Chef.
And did you think he was just like, you know, like I took a lot of hits to the head, but I could still write a 20-part miniseries in the Star Lore. And she's like, ah, oh, crap. And then she was not happy with me with posting that joke on Facebook. But you know,
yeah, he made all those Marvel movies, and then he sent a penis picture to his assistant. I mean, I forget what order he did it in, but he definitely did both.
Yeah, but I guess we're gonna bring on two guests today. So let's get to our first one here now. We're going to get Howard Bloom on the show. Now, Howard Bloom is an author. He's wrote a whole bunch of different books. He was a music publicist in the 70s, 80s, 90s for like small bands. Like, you may have heard of a guy named Prince, Mike. A guy Prince named Billy Joel, Styx.
Oh, okay. He did the Avengers movie. Yeah.
Correct. So we're going to get Howard on the show. A really interesting guy, has a really long career. But what's really interesting about Howard, he's like just as into like amazing, like speaking of the Hulk, he's like into like all these like ridiculous science facts, and he worked in science and all. You guys got to hear the interview. So without further ado, here is Howard Bloom.
There we go.
The 42nd try is the best try.
Yes, if you don't get it. That must have meant at some point Howard was in one room, I was in one room, and Mike was in one room.
Amazing.
Which is
the gifts of technology.
It's a very avant-garde way of interviewing. You don't know what you're asking or responding. You piece it all together, right, at the end, you know?
It's like a little scavenger hunt, if you will. You know, we leave a question in each room, and it's your duty to transfer over to us.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad we finally made it. It took us 15 or 16 minutes.
I know. We apologize for that. But Howard, welcome to the show. Thank you for giving us a little bit of your time here. I guess my question to start with you know, we've obviously been in this pandemic for, God, what are we, 7 months now, 8 months? And where a lot of creative people have had to kind of figure out new ways of creating content or creating art. Now, whether you were doing books, whether you were doing publicist work, how are you occupying your time during this unprecedented time?
Well, I got a head start in 1988 because I became ill and I was stuck in a bed for 15 years, and I was too weak to talk, and I was too weak to have another person in the room with me.
Wow.
And there was the thing that had absolutely fascinated me in the 1970s that I envied university professors for having access to. It was called the internet. And then when I was doing my field work in mass behavior, founding the biggest PR firm in the music industry and working with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Kiss, Queen, Run-DMC, Billy Joel, Billy Idol, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, Run-DMC, people like that, ZZ Top.
Who?
Joan Jett. Right. So in the middle, I got sick in the middle of all of that. Although I had started to write my first book, I'd gone back to my science by that point. And it took me 3 years to begin to reorganize an identity, a sense of humanity. I had no sense of humanity anymore. I was stripped of it because I was stripped of every purpose I'd ever had in life, or so it seemed. And so I reinvented myself, or came back to life again, on this thing called the internet. So I spent my life in virtual reality. And so when this pandemic hit, it's nothing for me. It's absolutely nothing. This is the way I'm used to living. This is how I was born around 1991. And cyberspace is perfect for me. So back in those days, while I was stuck in bed, I founded two international scientific groups and I wrote 3 books. And these days, during the COVID pandemic, I'm promoting one book, Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me, A Search for Soul in the Power Pits of Rock and Roll. I'm running 4 different groups in the space community. One group that Buzz Aldrin conned me into founding 15 years ago. Another group that includes the former governor of New York State, who like me is a Democrat. Newt Gingrich, who obviously isn't a Democrat, a 3-star general, and the guy who was the head of the science committee in Congress, and two other space groups. So I'm so busy that it's ridiculous. I am totally overbooked, to say the least. Of course, my romantic life is all electronic. But back when I resurrected in 1991, thanks to the internet, I had to get used to the fact that that was the only avenue for my romantic life. So having an all electronic romantic life is not new. And back then I said, souls come alive online. And what I meant was, you didn't choose the body that you got. You could be like one of my artists in the days when I founded an art studio was 4'9". He was a little round person. He didn't choose to have that body. You can be 350 pounds and have the face of a bulldog, and you didn't choose that body. But once you go out online, people who meet you are oblivious. They do not see your height. They do not see your weight. They do not see your facial characteristics. They see your fucking soul. And there is a huge advantage in that. So thanks to COVID, I lost the love of my life. I was supposed to go to South Africa, and all of a sudden there were no airlines. Airlines were canceled. And she got a live-in boyfriend instead of me. And I found a new girlfriend. She's 26 years old. And she loves me dearly. It's just amazing. And I'm working my fucking ass off. I'm having a good time. How are you guys doing with the COVID?
Oh, we're bored. We haven't done anything in the last 6 months and all. I think, Scott, you had a kid or something.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
about
yeah.
it.
Is that all?
Yeah, I did the whole have God. A kid thing a week ago. So that's probably why our meetings. That's probably why our meetings got screwed up. I probably running on 45 minutes of sleep and sent you all separate invitations.
Oh, God. Amazing. Amazing.
Howard, like, just looking at your resume, like, even at 16, you're into cancer research, you're into music, you're into psychology. Just how is it? What makes you go into all these things? Do you just get bored fast? Does something interest you fast? Do you just set a goal and say, when I hit it, go on to the next thing? What gets your motor running?
Well, I have a lucky accident. When I was a child, nobody wanted me in my hometown of Buffalo, New York. Other kids wanted to have nothing to do with me, and my parents didn't want to have anything to do with me. And one day there appeared in my lap a book. Now, you know how you know the location of every single book in your house, because they've been in the same location ever since you came to consciousness. This is a book that had no place in my parents' shelves. I don't know where the fuck it came from. And so I opened it, and it said, the first two rules of science are these: the truth at any price, including the price of your life. And it gave the example of Galileo, and it told the story as if Galileo were willing to go to the stake to defend his truth, which 30 years later I discovered was wrong. But I needed that heroic, mythic version of the tale. And the second rule of science: look at things run under your nose as if you'd never seen them before, and then proceed from there. Look for things that are invisible to you and everybody around you, things you take for granted, and then proceed from there. And it gave the example of Anton von Leeuwenhoek, who invented the microscope and turned a lens down on pond water and discovered that we shared this planet and had ever since our birth with things he called animalcules, microorganisms, a whole world of beasts and creatures we didn't know existed before. So basically, I was recruited into science at the age of 10 by Galileo and Anton von Leeuwenhoek. And all of a sudden, I had a group of playmates I could hang with who would never toss me out, who would never reject me, who would never move a baseball game from the field they were planning to play into an entirely different field just to get away from me, which happened to me in my childhood. Why? Because these guys were dead. They had reached out across 350 years to save me, and then they couldn't reject me because they had died 350 years ago. So that science became my life. And somehow I picked up the message that science is about omnivorous curiosity. Science is about, since look, we think God is omniscient, right? Those of us who believe in God. But I was an atheist. So if you don't believe there's a God, where's this idea of omniscience come from? It's an aspiration. And in science, you have the aspiration to omniscience, the aspiration to know and explain absolutely everything that runs across your past. path, including things other people are ignoring. Remember, look at things right under your nose that you and people around you just do not see, and bring them into visibility. So I've been interested in all the sciences my limited brain, and it is a limited brain, can comprehend ever since the age of 10. At the age of 10, I started reading two books a day, and they were science and science fiction. Two books a day, one under the school desk during the day, and another one when I got home in the late afternoon. So I have always felt that I'll give you another story. First, I accumulated my first genuine scientific credentials. They were tiny ones when I was 12. I built my first Boolean algebra machine. I co-designed a computer that won some science fair awards. And I was taken off to a meeting with the head of the graduate physics department at the University of Buffalo. Now, what graduate physics department head is going to want to deal with a 12-year-old? So I imagine it was supposed to be a 5-minute courtesy meeting to somehow placate my mother, who could be ferocious about these things. And it ended up being an hour because we were discussing the hottest topic in science at the time, which is Big Bang versus steady state theory of the universe and the interpretation of the Doppler shift. And he came out of his office and he put his hand on my shoulder and said to my mom, "You don't have to save for grad school for him. He'll get fellowships in theoretical physics at any school he wants. That's it, at any school he wants." And then when I was 16, I was working at the world's largest cancer research facility and allegedly doing research on the immune system, but in reality, I was fascinated by something else. I basically was the core of a discussion group that gathered every day at the cafeteria. And the problem that bothered me was called the CPT problem, charge, parity, and time problem. If matter and antimatter are made in equal amounts at the same time, where's all the antimatter? And I came up, it took me 2.5 months, I came up with a theory of the beginning, middle, and end of the universe that answered that question and that predicted something that wouldn't be found for 38 years, dark energy. So my imperative, the test I was given when I signed on to science as my religion, was understand absolutely everything. Understand especially the things that no one else in science sees or that no one else around you sees, which means taking all of the sciences and all of the arts and all the history my limited brain can comprehend, and fashioning them into new perceptual lenses with which you can see everything around you and everything inside of you from a radically different point of view. And that's the goal of my books.
Jeez. That's it? So simple.
Yeah.
Now, how does one, like, normally, you know, you get, like, a lot of times you have separate brain people who are very scientific like yourself, and then you don't often think of them as combined with the rock stars and the creative people and how to sell to the public. Where did you make this turn from this super scientific child and young adult and adult to all of a sudden shifting into the music industry? It seems like a very, very separate world.
Well, it's a very odd combination, but here's the deal. So I'm 12 years old.
I've probably been
reading Bertrand Russell on Christianity. One way or the other, I suddenly realize I'm an atheist. But my bar mitzvah is coming up, and it's the first party I'm ever going to be invited to in Buffalo, New York. And presents are coming up. And if I confess to myself that I'm an atheist, I'm screwed. I can't have my bar mitzvah. So I put that recognition in a dark closet of my mind where I can avoid it and go on with the bar mitzvah. And then the bar mitzvah is a big success and I get tons of presents and I spend 2 months writing thank you notes to everybody. And at the end of those 2 months, I am suddenly free to admit I'm an atheist. But the end of those 2 months comes at the end of August. And the end of August is right around the corner from the beginning of September. And there is a unique meaning to the beginning of September in the Jewish religion. And I'm Jewish. I'm a Jewish atheist. So my parents, who are not observant and normally do not go to the synagogue, they do not pray, they do not do anything religious at all. But these high holidays mean the world to them for some reason. So they managed to stuff me into a suit, which is nigh onto impossible because I hate suits. And they managed to stuff me into their blue Fraser four-door automobile. And they managed to drive me all the way to Richmond Avenue, where the synagogue is. And then I refused to go any further. So I'm holding on to this sturdily made American door frame with both hands, trying to keep them from dragging me out of the car. And they are holding onto my ankles, trying to drag me out of the car and drag me up the street like a sack of meat. And something hits me. Galileo made his discoveries because he took a top secret military instrument from Holland that was designed for horizontal viewing. It was designed to see the troops of the Spanish coming over the horizon before those troops realized you had a bead on them. It was a tube with a lens at each end. And he dared do something audacious. He took that instrument and turned it not horizontally. He turned it up at the sky. Now, that was a ridiculous idea for a very simple reason. Everybody knew exactly what was in the sky. That was God's underwear. That was the underside of God's living room rug. Aristotle had told us that the perfect shape is the sphere and the circle. So obviously everything up there, because it was God's territory, was perfect, which means it was a circle and a sphere. And Aristotle discovered these craggy, rocky things up there in the sky. And he changed our entire relationship to nature and the cosmos. And Anton von Leeuwenhoek he was a draper. He imported fabrics to Holland. And so he used a lens for horizontal viewing to look at fabrics to see how tight the weave was, how perfectly these things were made. And then he had a bright idea. Instead of using this lens horizontally, he turned it down and he looked at pond water and fresh human sperm. And we won't speculate on where he got the fresh human sperm. But at any rate, I suddenly realized as I'm clinging to this door frame, and as my parents are nearly shredding my socks and pulling my shoes off, there are no gods in the sky. I'm an atheist. I know that. There are no gods beneath the earth. I know that because I'm an atheist. But there are gods in this scene. Where are the gods? They are in this incredible, intense passion with which my parents are willing to drag me up the street and turn my face, dragging on the pavement, into hamburger. Me, their firstborn son. And if there are gods inside of my parents, then there are gods inside of me. So one of my tasks in science becomes to find the gods inside of us. And meantime, I take the money for my bar mitzvah and I buy something that's brand new. It's like a small suitcase and you open it up and it's called a hi-fi system. And it does much better with the reproduction of sound than anything that came before it, because its amplifier separates the high notes from the low notes and sends the low notes to a big speaker called a woofer and to a tiny speaker called a tweeter. And this makes all the difference in the world. And I start buying records like crazy, but they're Rachmaninoff, Beethoven, Bartok, Stravinsky. Why? Because rock and roll music is the music of the kids who beat the shit out of it. And I want to have nothing to do with it. And then there's a whole bunch of adventures in between, and I hitchhike and ride the rails and accidentally help start the hippie movement, which is in my book, How I Accidentally Started the 60s. And then I go back to NYU and I get really ferocious about wanting to get straight A's. And so I get them. And indeed, the prediction of the head of the graduate physics department comes true. I get fellowships at four different grad schools, but they're all in this field that doesn't have a name yet, called neuroscience. I'm going to have to paste the program together myself in college. And I have a sudden realization just after I graduate in the summer. And it is that college or grad school is going to be Auschwitz for the mind. Why? Because one of the great mysteries I'm seeking is the gods inside. And that's a scientific obligation. Why? Because the job of science is to understand absolutely everything, especially the things that other people do not see as a legitimate field of science. That's rule number two of science. And if I go to grad school, I'm going to be giving paper and pencil tests to 22 college students at a time. How many ecstatic experiences, how many experiences of the gods inside are you going to see giving paper and pencil tests to 22 college students? Zero. So I would spend the rest of my life separated from one of the key phenomena that interests me the most, the ecstatic experience. And there's a couple of other things. When I was in high school, I was just as unpopular as I'd ever been. But there were functional committees that had to get things done. And, you know, after the kids were busy voting the most popular kid, the president, the second most popular kid, the vice president, and the most popular girl, the class secretary, and the most popular Jew, the class treasurer. Those were the popularity positions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to these functional positions, popular kids don't like having to do things in the real world. They get by on their looks and their charm, not on their capabilities. So I was voted the head of this thing called the program committee for 2 years in a row. And we had a school assembly every day, 5 days a week, before we started classes. And I programmed two of them, and I emceed all of them. So emceeing every day, going up in front of an audience of 350 people, the stage fright for the first 3 months is excruciating. And then you get used to it. And, you know, walking up in front of an audience and talking to an audience is as natural as breathing. And one day the juniors come to me and they have this very strange request, ironic request. They say, "We're having a dance. Could you please advertise it for us?" And this is ironic because if there is a dance anywhere in Buffalo, New York, I am cordially invited to stay as far away as possible, preferably Cleveland or Albuquerque. Nonetheless, I agree to advertise this dance for them. Now, every 2 years, my parents would try to make me normal. And 1 year, their attempt to make me normal was to send me to dance class. So I spent a year in dance class. None of the girls would dance with me. Occasionally, the instructors would. And I proved that I was totally incapable of learning how to dance the box step, the foxtrot, or the waltz, any dance. But to advertise this dance for the juniors, I put a record on the turntable behind the stage. I went up on the stage. And since I can't dance, I moved freeform in a way that nobody had ever seen before. Apparently, I looked like a Looney Tune drawn by Chuck Jones, the guy who made all the Looney Tune characters, on a night when he had just dropped LSD. And so here I am in front of 350 kids who hate me. And I saw the face of the girl who hated me most melting. I saw her eyes widening. I saw her pupils dilating. I saw her energy blend with the energy of everybody else in the room because all of their eyes were widening and their pupils were dilating. And I had my first out-of-body experience. I felt I was up on the ceiling watching all of this take place, and I saw the energy of the audience melt into a big collective amoeba-like form. And I saw that energy reach a pseudopod out to me. And channel its energy through me. And I saw myself as an empty pipe with that energy going through me to somewhere around my head, being utterly transmogrified and flowing back through the audience again through my movements. And then I saw their eyes widening even further and even more energy coming from them. Remember, I was on the ceiling watching all of this take place. And when it was over, the audience did something it had practiced all its life. It did it with utter and complete perfection, even though it had never done it before in my time in that high school and would never do it again, not for homecoming queens, not for football heroes, not for anyone. They surged to the foot of the stage. They picked me up off the proscenium. They put me on their shoulders. They carried me out of the auditorium, and they carried me up the walkway. To the building above where we did our classes, and only then did they put me down. So I had been looking for the gods inside since I was 12 years old. Now I was 16. Guess what the fuck I had found? Totally by accident, the gods inside. And later on, Okay, so there's another little mini adventure. So when I was a junior, at NYU, I was taking a lot of poetry courses because poetry meant the world to me. Poetry was able to grasp certain aspects of the world that my science just couldn't get a handle on at all. Inarticulable things. And somehow poetry was able to articulate them. So poetry was a ferocious interest. And I was taking a course from the poet in residence at NYU, who was known for launching the career of a whole bunch of people who were famous at the time. And one day he said, look, wait until everybody leaves the room. Close the door. Lock it. Sit down in this chair. I have something to say to you. This did not sound good. Not at all. So I waited till everybody left the room. I closed the door. I sat in the bawling out seat. And the poet in residence said, look, you, last year I asked you to be on the staff of the literary magazine. You never even showed up. This year I'm telling you, you are the literary magazine. You are the editor of the literary magazine. You do not even have a faculty advisor. Once you walk out the door, you're it. Now walk out that door. So I walked out the door looking utterly perplexed because I thought literary magazines were the most boring things in the world. You know, they have this eggshell blue covers and this terrible choice of typeface. It's as if nobody has any aesthetic sense whatsoever. And if you had a room in which you had a rip-roaring orgy and you took a literary magazine and you threw it into that room, the orgy would end and everybody in the room would flee within 5 minutes. So the last thing in the world I wanted to do was edit a literary magazine. So I looked as if somebody just hit me over the head with a sledgehammer standing outside the classroom in the hallway. And a kid I didn't know came up to me and said, you look disturbed about something. Can I help you? And I said, yes, I've just been named the editor of the literary magazine. And he said, why don't you come down for a cup of coffee? Now, remember, nobody in Buffalo, New York wanted to have anything to do with me, right? So I didn't know any human rituals. I had guinea pigs, lab rats, and guppies in my bedroom. And they don't do things like have a cup of coffee. So I had no idea what that meant. But I meekly followed him down to a coffee shop and ordered a glass of water. And he ordered a cup of coffee. And he asked me one of the most important questions in my life, which is, if you could do anything you wanted with this magazine, what would it be? And I said it would be a picture book. So in addition to hunting for a literary staff, I went out hunting for an art staff. And the literary magazine, it came out in, it was called the Washington Square Review. I put it out in a 12 by 12 inch format, like a record album. It had the most gorgeous paper you've ever seen. It was in three colors. It was filled with art. And we won two National Academy of Poets prizes. So the poetry was obviously good. But it was a visual glory. And when I came to the, first of all, the first issue made such a splash on campus that I was called to a meeting with the Student Activities Committee. I'd never heard of the Student Activities Committee. I didn't know that such a thing existed. I had no idea what they did. But I came to the meeting and they said, your magazine was absolutely gorgeous and glorious. We're doubling your budget for the next issue. Have you ever heard in your life of a budget for anything being doubled?
No.
I mean, I hadn't.
Right.
At any rate, so the next issue was the Sex and Death issue, and it was printed in five colors, and it had some of the most astonishing paper you've ever seen, a whole different paper than we used in the first issue. We used the 12 by 12 format again, 12 inches by 12 inches square format for the Washington Square Review. And when my literary staff saw the direction I was taking this, the Sex and Death issue, half of them quit. But we put it out anyway. And the faculty advisor, the poet in residence, stopped speaking to me entirely. But I got calls from the art director's Look magazine, which was this gorgeous, full-color, glossy, biweekly news magazine. And the Evergreen Review, which was the leading bohemian magazine in the world, really slick, beautifully done. and Boy's Life, the Boy Scout magazine.
I remember Boy
Scout. Of all things. Yep. Which was a bit ironic because I had been thrown out of the Boy Scouts at the age of 11 for incompetence at Morse code. And if they hadn't thrown me out for incompetence at Morse code, they could have thrown me out for incompetence at knot tying. So, I'd been heavily engaged in school. It had given me something to do for 4 years. And now all of a sudden, the day after graduation, I had absolutely nothing to do. So I couldn't stand that. And I made a modest effort to try to kill myself. And I was thrown into a mental institution. And I spent 2 weeks, fascinating weeks there, learning all kinds of things. And then they threw me out for good behavior. So after I'd been thrown out of the mental institution, needless to say, I hadn't had time to get a summer job yet. I was supposed to go to Columbia in neuroscience in September. I walked into the home, into the apartment of one. Are we running short on time?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it looks like we got 10 minutes on this one.
10 minutes. All right. Well, basically, so I walked into the apartment of my most brilliant artist. And there was no furniture in the room. And he and his wife and his three-year-old were all on the floor crying. And I asked them what the matter was. And they said, our electricity or our furniture has been repossessed. Our electricity is being turned off. Our phone is being turned off. And we're about to be evicted for our apartment. And I said, what? Your artist is the most brilliant stuff I've ever seen in my life. If I take that out for 2 weeks, I'll get you a job and you'll be able to pay your rent. Just put your work on a portfolio. And he said, well, look, if I put my work in a portfolio, I have to put in the work of my best friend because we came here from Boston to start an art studio. So I didn't care. I wanted to save this guy. I thought the work of his best friend was nauseating, was just terrible. And so I started to take the artwork out. And instead of going to grad school in neuroscience, I ended up founding this art studio and building it up for 3 years and going on the cover of Art Direction magazine and inventing a new animation technique for NBC TV. And we got as a client all seven of ABC's FM stations, which were about to transition to an extremely risky new format called Progressive Radio, where instead of just playing the top 40, you let the DJ play anything he wanted at all, including an entire album from beginning to end, if that's what he felt like. It was a supremely risky move. And we did all the graphics, and they had asked me to form an advertising agency for them, and I didn't want to learn time buying, so I didn't do that. But the promotion director tried to school me on this stuff I really didn't know called rock and roll. And one day she said, look, we've got a live performance coming up in Studio B. I can give you tickets. If I give you tickets, will you come? And I said, yes. So I took Peter Bramley, my brilliant artist who was about to be thrown out of his apartment. We went together. There was a piano player on stage. Peter embarrassed the hell out of me. He stood during the entire concert, whooping, whistling, hollering. And there was no way people wouldn't know that I had brought him. I wanted to crawl under the seat and die. But the piano player did an excellent job, and they turned that into a live studio album. And the piano player was named Elton John. And I later learned in my own performances that you take the person who is the most enthusiastic person in the audience, and you feed off that person. You play to that person, and you try to spread the energy you're getting from that person around the entire auditorium to everybody. So Peter Bramley, the artist who had embarrassed the hell out of me, made that concert. And you probably hear that concert on the radio all the time these days, because it's a classic Elton John album. And that's how I, by accident, tripped into rock and roll. And I discovered that in rock and roll, I had finally landed by accident into exactly the place I needed to be, the land where the gods were. And the whole story of that is in Einstein, Michael Jackson, and Me, A Search for Soul in the Power Pits of Rock and Roll, which is this book. So there you have it. An introduction to the story.
I mean, I got it. Looking up, like, you $28 billion worth of like dealings and money that you made with these performers. Obviously, anytime you try to bring logic to art, a lot of times there's a bunch of pushback from the art. So I'm just kind of curious, like, your conversations with any of these artists, like, how much is it, okay, I trust in you versus I'm the artiste where you tell me, like, do something different with
the... Well, if you came to me as a potential client, I gave you a little speech and it went like this. You have to understand if you're going to work with, first of all, if you expect me to fashion an artificial mask for you, and an image, and to sit here like a guy in a plaid suit with a cigar in his right hand and say, kid, I'm going to make you a star. I'm going to send you to my best competitor. You'll be in his office in 2 hours. If you're going to work with me, you have to understand music is not about an exchange of pieces of plastic. Remember, it was all vinyl in those days. Music is not about an exchange of downloads. Music is not about an exchange of money. Music is about an exchange of human soul. And if you're going to work with me, you're going to give me 6 weeks to study everything you've ever said in print, every lyric you've ever written, every song you've ever sung, every album you've ever put out. And at the end of 6 weeks, I'm going to come to spend time with you in your own environment with no wives, no managers, no handlers, just you and me. And what am I going to be looking for? Well, you're on deadline for an album. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You sit in front of a blank computer screen or a blank piece of paper, and you know you cannot write a lyric. You wonder how you've ever written a lyric in the past. And on a reasonably good day, by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there is a lyric in front of you. And once or twice in your life, that lyric is so perfect that it feels as if it wrote itself through you. I am going to find the gods inside of you that wrote that lyric. When you go on stage, you have the kind of experience that I had when I was 16. You see the pupils of the audience dilating. You see their eyes widening. You could hear their breathing change. You see them meld together in a big amoeba blob. You have an out-of-body experience. You see the collective energy of that audience, whether it's 700 people or 70,000 people, go through you as if you were a pipe, be transmogrified somewhere around your head, and flow back to that audience. And you are danced for 70 minutes like a puppet on stage, out of your own control. Something else controls you. And when you come off stage, it is really hard for your normal personality to come back into your body again. Well, those gods that danced you on stage, I'm going to find them. And if you're willing to let me do that, and if you're willing to let me keep you true to the gods inside of you as they change year after year after year, I will work with you.
That's awesome.
Howard, so that was it.
Yeah. Howard, you're a very fascinating man. I could tell you that much. I feel like we could do 12 editions of these interviews and just and just start scratching the surface on some of your career and life. And, you know, maybe we'd love to have you back on in the future to go, you know, go into the next step and talk about some of the amazing work you've done. But you have a book that you're promoting. Where can people go check you out? And where's the best place for them to go check the book out?
The best place is Amazon.com. Or you can go to Barnes & Noble's online website. They both have the book. Going to local bookstores is hard because who knows which ones are open and when they're open these days. Mm-hmm. It's COVID time. But Amazon for me at least, has been a godsend.
That's awesome. Howard, thanks so much for your time. Stay safe out there, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Okay, Scott, Michael, I'll see you again soon.
All right, take awesome. Care, Howard.
Okay, have a good night.
All right, Howard Bloom. And, you know, we're gonna actually put two guests on this show. It's our last one of the year, so we want to kind of get them on out to the listening public, if you will. Mike, who's our second guest?
Our second guest tonight is recording artist and concert promoter Soho Johnny. Soho Johnny is a real estate mogul out of New York City, but he's also known for throwing these huge concerts around the world and being a philanthropist. He just recently did a huge Christmas soiree concert with some guests, Fred Schneider from the B-52s, Mickey Burns, Stephen Perkins, to name a few people that helped out benefit the Let Me Help Incorporated Foundation. So we're going to talk to them about what it takes to bring all these stars together and do these soirees to get money for charity.
Let's get Soho Johnny on the line.
Hello.
What's going on, John? How are you?
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
We are
doing well. Doing well.
We're doing great. How are you, man?
Greetings from Westchester County, New York. Where do you gentlemen hail from?
I'm currently sitting in Denville, New Jersey.
I am formerly from New Jersey. Now I reside in Douglasville, Georgia.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. A little warmer there than it is here, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Not really. We're
change of the seasons.
Yeah, we're probably in the 20s tonight. We're pretty much same as the Northeast.
Yeah.
Oh, really? In Georgia? Really?
Yeah. Basically, Georgia is just extra summer and extra winter. There's no real spring or fall. You're either burning or you're freezing.
Okay. I always wanted a longer summer, but it's okay. We deal with what we have to deal with. You know, we take it on the chin. We go forward because that's the spirit to keep.
That's it, man.
That's the way to do it.
So, John, first off, welcome to the show. Thanks for giving us a few minutes here. So let me ask you, as a guy involved in music and production and things like that, and how has this pandemic shutdown with live events and music and whatnot affected you, and how have you kind of dealt with being within the entertainment industry and kind of figuring out how to navigate these waters?
Are we recording now? Are we live yet?
We're good to go. Yep.
Cool. Okay. Well, like everyone else, it's a interesting journey that we're going through, and it's hard, and there's a certain amount of suffering as we have in life. It's just a little bit more ramped up and, you know, taking on a kind of a Twilight Zone mentality here in most of us in our lifetime, certainly for myself. I didn't even know what a pandemic was, right?
Right.
And the far-reaching repercussions of how it affect not only the health of many of us and the risk and also economic circumstances. But putting aside all that, because we hear about that every day, for me personally, it segues into kind of organically, I call myself the accidental tourist of how I, Soho Johnny, that name became from. Not that it's really about me, but this is my story. One of the things that I usually talk about, you know, besides, you know, where I was brought up and everything, is about over 26 years ago when I lost my dad to cancer. That spurred me into doing, because I was already involved somewhat in entertainment organically, and then I started doing concerts to raise money for American Cancer Society, and started doing gigs and grew from there. And I will share with everybody here that I too myself suffered the loss of my mom earlier this year to COVID.
Jeez.
And
sorry to hear that.
Just like I did in my dad's name, you know, for everyone that suffers from cancer or that deals with this terrible disease, here we are with a pandemic. Who knew what that was? And, you know, I got a black eye and I'm mourning my mom. But I had last year started, because I used to do these concerts and raise money and just give a check like to the American Cancer Society, that type of thing.
Right.
And I said, this is going to be taking a notch up and let me just help found a foundation. That sounds funny. And which is what I did. And I founded a foundation I had on the shelf last year called letmehelpinc.org. I mean, that's the website, but it's Let Me Help Inc. is the actual foundation. The foundation could give to multiple charities and it could pivot as long as the charitable purpose. It doesn't have to be pigeonholed just like the cancer. And I took it off the shelf, you know, my mom's name. So how I reacted to this pandemic is, you know, I just like I did with my dad, and just kind of want to channel the energy and try to use it constructively, because life isn't perfect. We all are here for an unlimited amount of time. And my philosophy, and I say that we're all role models to each other, you know, I just wanted to do something in her name and everyone else that's dealing with this or has lost like that. So I took it off the shelf and I did this virtual fundraising concert that I guess we'll talk about in a little bit, only about a week ago. We can have a November 24th. So how I reacted to it, I'm a human being, of course, you know, I'm mourning my mom. And, you know, it's there's a certain fear in the streets. But, you know, we have to remember to remain centered on the facts, right? Because fear is fear itself. It's just an emotion, and it's part of who we are. We go through it. But how we react to it and how we conduct outreach to each other is part of the, you know, the guts of humanity and spirit of humanity, which is a big part of organically of what I've kind of organically got involved in this entertainment gig in the, in, you know, the latter part of my life in this platform called So Johnny.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with something so close to the heart, is it really hard? Cause I mean, when you're trying to make like a virtual party, you are trying to make it like a little fun. So is it kind of almost hard to kind of separate what you're going through and the cause with kind of the main goal of like making people happy and contributing to the cause?
I think, you know, I allow myself, and I tell people to, not that, you know, I'm just sharing my, you know, how I get by, and, you know, it's important to allow ourselves to deal with mourning or deal with grief. They call it different stages of death when you deal with a death in a family or someone, a loved one, right? You go through anger, you know, and you're angry, then you're very, very, you know, you're mourning, you're sad, you go through all these stages. That's human. It's important that we go through that, because if there's anything that defines our lives here, it's death itself, to know that it's temporary, right? We value what is scarce, what doesn't last forever. And certainly that is our lives and our time here. So with me, I guess it's kind of a therapy for me, with my mom, in doing it. And it certainly helps a lot to be blessed as I've been and get all the love of doing these charity events and bringing artists together. And when the artists come, you know, I treat them like family. Okay. It's not just a gig where, you know, I'm just getting paid to do a show. And it's just, you know, everybody, you know, everybody's there, especially when there's a charitable purpose. It's just a lot of warmth, a lot of love. It puts wind into my sails, and it's kind of, as I would say, it's definitely a therapy, because I feel like I'm doing something good, and I'm feeling this love, and I'm saying, you know, if anything, if I could be just one little bit of a positive impression for someone else, you know, one ripple times millions of us at the same time could create, you know, a tidal wave of good-heartedness.
Yeah, so we would be remiss if we, like, for anyone who's listening to this episode, and we kind of just jumped into it, but let's backtrack a minute and kind of explain what Soho Johnny is, and what exactly, you know, we're kind of diving into it too quick. So what exactly is Soho Johnny, and what is your kind of goal, and where did you come up with the whole concept?
Well, I'm just a kid behind the desk. And I was brought up, my parents were living in the Big Apple in Manhattan. And I was, when I was a kid, I was there, and I was actually a nervous kid. I used to stutter, which is, you know, ironic. And I was blessed that I had a dad that, you know, four generations, even my grandfather had come to the country, and he started his living, he was a poor man in the Soho section of Manhattan. In the actual Soho district. And I guess he and my older uncle, they started this business, and there were several brothers, my father, and they ended up with a trucking business like in the 50s and the 60s. I was, you know, of course I, you know, it was my family, and I got involved, and we lived in an apartment in Stuyvesant Town, and then, which is Peter Cooperville, it was a big complex that many listeners may have heard of or know of, that MetLife built. And then my parents moved to, the Boogie Down Bronx, for the sister complex called MetLife Bill called Parkchester, another giant complex in the Bronx. And eventually, I was kind of the practical joker in school. I mean, I would always get in trouble, and it was kind of, and so my parents eventually bought a house, and there was a garage in the backyard. And in the garage, for some reason, I guess because I was kind of like infamous or whatever, a lot of my friends and people, kids from the neighborhood would flock towards that garage. And it had a strobe light and a black light. And I used to play rock music, which is now classic rock music. And I just developed my profound love of entertainment there. So in the meantime, I was brought up with my dad and got involved with his business and in real estate. I got involved with real estate with my family. I was blessed that I had a start in the Soho area. And I just got that nickname, Soho Johnny. It was one of the nicknames that kind of stuck, just because my family and my roots actually do come. To this day, we have a real estate company, peprealestate.com, in Soho, and have an office in Soho. And we rent out places and retail and commercial establishments, and either what we have or we'll just assist others in producing something.
Nice.
And when I hear like real estate in New York City, I'm thinking of like this real like cutthroat kind of vision of people and all just like tripping over people to get like millions of dollars. And then like when I think of entertainment, I feel like I just see like a relaxed, happy kind of time and all. I mean, kind of tells like, do you have a little of both sides, or what do you have to kind of switch back and forth when you do like the real estate thing to the entertainment thing?
You know, as you say that, I think of the duality I had as a kid. I mean, the Bronx when I was brought up was, you know, there was gangs on the street. Okay. And yet I was kind of like an honor student, but at night, you know, I kind of belonged in a gang. Not that I was a tough guy. I was actually more of a chicken, but you know, I kind of wore my colors back in the day because, you know, I wanted to get home from school, but, yeah, so I've loved real estate because, you know, we had this family business and it was great. And, you know, I studied on it and had a brokerage, and that was great. But, you know, as you just said, there's something to be said for entertainment and that connection. I mean, when I do shows or produce shows, you know, I'm not just, you know, writing a check and just assembling people together and doing it. I'm also one of the performers myself. I'm animated and I can't help myself. And I'm along with whoever is in the show, I'll be singing, I'll be dancing on choreography with some dancers, and I put on a show. And that umbilical cord with the audience that, you know, I mean, until I got involved with that, it gave me a more defined understanding about the artist. And, you know, besides having the talent, you know, being able to, you know, have that connection, that love from the audience is a feeling that is very, 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 I mean, we call it passion. It's a certain amount of passion. And when I tied it to philanthropy, in a sense, for charitable reasons, I kind of felt I hit the trifecta, because a lot of work goes into this. And again, I'm not trying to take credit for myself. It's really not about me. A lot of this is all about charity. But, you know, when you have that trifecta, as it's saying, a charitable purpose, and you have people coming to support you. I've met so many beautiful people through the charitable part aspect of all this. But despite the hard work, you know, I'm also having a great time. So I consider myself blessed. So it's a segue. It's kind of a, you're right, real estate, bricks and mortars, about the money. Of course, it's competitive, just like every business is competitive to a certain extent. But the entertainment is a breath of fresh air and was for me. But I kind of always had that seed in me. I didn't know it. I say my mom is the one who gave it to me, because she would have went further in her career in entertainment. She wasn't, because it was different days. I mean, she was born in 1927. You know, she used to dance something like the Rockettes, but not as famous as that. And she always had music in the household. Yeah. So I always say I got from my father a sense of humility and humanity, because everybody that he dealt with, you know, he walked away with a depression. He lived through the depression from nothing. And, you know, they would really like him. For my mom, it was the entertainment. So it's kind of, it was easy for me to adapt to that. And interesting, you're right. It's a beautiful combination. But Soho Johnny just kind of organically grew. I call myself the accidental tourist in all this. Yeah. I really mean it. I didn't expect organically to get to the stage it is now, and all these wonderful things that are going on, and doors that have opened for me, and different types of acting. I'm recording my own material, and I'm going to be recording some songs, and we've got some collaborations going on. It's really been a wonderful journey. It's not easy like anything else, but I say on my website, sohojohnny.com, every day is a blessing and a gift.
So I got to get into this virtual concert you had. We're recording this now early in December. This was about a week and a half ago. You had a Let Me Help, I Am No Joke concert, a virtual concert. Now, some of the names on this concert are ridiculous. You had Patrick Stewart, Kenny Aronoff, Steve Vai, Cedric the Entertainer, Josh Holm from Queens of the Stone Age, one of our former guests on the show, Andrew W.K., Charlie Sheen. Like, this is quite a eclectic Ozzy and Sharon Osbourne. This is quite an eclectic group, and how does one go about putting this kind of, you know, variety together?
You know, it's a lot of luck and having a great team around me.
I also love Slash and Jeff Goldblum together on the flyer next to each other. It's great. Something I never thought I'd see. But
listen, you know, I'm still to this day overwhelmed as you say that, but it was just having people around me like my mentor, John Valesco, Eileen Shapiro, Jimmy Starr, my co-producer for the hashtag I Am No Joke anti-bullying mandate of the show, Andrew Cole, who's a artist in his own right, who got lots of some of those names involved too. I mean, between having permission to do footage for the anti-bullying for some of them, to shouts out or performances. I don't know if you've seen. I mean, it was daunting. It was 6 hours, so maybe, you know, a lot of people didn't see all of it. And you know, it's licensed, so it's not something that we can just air it again so easy. Okay, you know, you have to have permission for a lot of intellectual property, as many of the viewers would know. But yeah, so it was a lot of. You know, it's almost like, you know, it kind of steamrolled in such a short period of time. I put the word out there. I had a lot of right people around me. And, you know, and I want to give most of the credit to them, because I kind of just, it felt like I wrote some, you know, I had the idea, or maybe I wrote some checks, and yeah, I financed, I did everything, you know, about my mom and everything. And I just wanted to, you know, had to be virtual, but, you know, I felt that there was a need. We have to fill up the gap for entertainment. We have to get people to smile. And I just kind of lit the fuse on the fireworks here, and I had the right people around me and connections. And maybe it's just good timings, because, you know, a lot of these artists and everything, they bandied about, because, you know, I think a lot of these artists are double celebrities in my mind, for the ones that give back. Yep. Something like this, you know, to me, you know, there's so many great people out there. Like, I'm reading up on Keanu Reeves the other day, and, you know, if you hear his story, how he's given back so much ridiculously and what he did. And, you know, like, it was a Gary Sinise, what he's involved with certain philanthropy.
Big and, chair, yep.
You know, and hear stories like that. It says, you know, these people don't have to do that, okay? They're really, you know, and I say it doesn't matter who we are. We don't have to be celebrities to be role models to each other, right? So it doesn't matter what you are or what you look like. When you walk out your door, and you greet, meet somebody, you may put a smile on someone's face you don't know, but that little bit makes a difference. You know, we're all role models to each other, and it's important for us to always remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Mike's role model, so, you know.
It's true. It's an honor every week to see you, Scott.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
Johnny, what do you think is the hardest thing? Is it getting the entertainment, working with them, or getting them back for another project?
I think it's very individualistic, because entertainers come, you know, most of them will have, you know, in order to be entertainment, you have to have some sort of ego. And I'm not saying in a negative way, okay? But yeah, because you're out there and you have to have ego in order to perform and you know, to feel great. But I think it's very individualistic. Most of everyone that I've dealt with, you know, have been great, especially when there's philanthropy involved. I think it's just wonderful. And they just want to help. I think a lot of the hard work goes into the editing and the organization and synchronizing everyone together and getting the team together. Because at the end of the day, just picture trying to do, you know, paint the Mona Lisa or something, right? But everyone is allowed 10 strokes only. OK, okay? So you got to pick your 10 strokes. And at the end of the day, the strokes alone mean nothing. But at the end of the day, hopefully you're going to make something. And I'm very fortunate because I feel that we did great. And again, I just feel like I'm just on the train here. And to me, even myself towards the end, towards right before the concert, I didn't know exactly the final product because of all of the editing and last minute things that go. It was a 4-hour show originally.
Yeah.
And then it became 6 hours as there's more artists wanted to come on and they were reaching out to us. And it was just wonderful.
That's awesome. John, you seem like a really humble guy with a heart in the right place. If people like are interested in putting on an event or they hear this and they're like, oh, okay, that's cool. Like I'm kind of interested or I have a cause or something. Where's like the best place for them to go check you out and get some information?
SohoJohnny.com is the main website URL right now. SohoJohnny.com. There's a mailing list there to everyone. I encourage everyone to go there to get email blasts from us to see what's going on. Of course, the foundation is letmehelpinc.org, not .com, .org, the O-R-G, letmehelpinc.org. People could just pop me an email, John@SohoJohnny.com, and give a shout out or anything that has to do with charity, any suggestions, info@letmehelpinc.org. I encourage anybody out there to reach out and, my door is open and the house of Soho Johnny has no diversity, has no politics, anybody's welcome. That's basically where it came from in my heart was based on outreach and music being the tie that binds. It's a common denominator for us all.
That's great.
Out of curiosity, just with a nickname like Soho Johnny, it's almost weird when somebody calls you by like your full name. It's almost weird. Like somebody goes, Mr. Pasquale and you're, who? Oh, yeah, that's me.
Yes, that metamorphosis has been occurring more and more. People either call me Soho or Soho Johnny now. And either way, it's fine for me. I mean, I put Soho Johnny is over here, and I'm just this regular guy. And I'm just having a great time. The purpose is, I have it on the website, the breadth of love is spoken in the language of musical expression. We are now helping, select artists in their careers. I don't want to say we're picky, but I never want to overpromise and underdeliver. We only could take a few people. We did a deal with the SMC Group, wonderful, talented guy, Maurice Hamilton, my partner. We're working with him, and we will take some aspiring artists and we'll lock them in with contracts with multinational corporations like Coca-Cola or whatever, be like a spokesman or a commercial or a jingle or things like that. So it's been interesting. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. We're bringing in with my friend Mike Becerra and his team, Animazix, which is a big rock group from Japan. Oh, nice. We're bringing them in. We're doing children's shows here in the U.S. And that's going to be, I think, December 11th. And it was at about a week and a half from now. So right around the holidays. And, we're probably going to be doing something streaming for the holidays, for Christmas and Hanukkah, or just the holiday season in general, maybe some Christmas caroling. So listen, it's all about the spirit. It's all about the journey. Money has its place, right? Business is important. We have to pay the bills. That's the structure that we survive, right? But a lot of exciting things in that. We have something on Broadway that's percolating now. In Broadway, the theater district in Manhattan. And that looks like it'll be raising some money for theatrical arts for the children in schools because there's cutbacks and they have more materials for theatrical arts. So
that's great.
That's kind of some of the things that we're involved with, or it's just kind of gestating as we go along. We released a song, I Promise You, with Star Hansen. We did a video, and it's I could go on now, but I'm not. Listen, it's not. Again, I want to say this again. It's not about me. I'm having a great time, so I'm appreciating just being here. And you know what? I give a shout out to both of you, Scott and Mike, because especially during this pandemic, having the show that you have is keeping the line on for a lot of people in form of entertainment. So thank you guys.
Oh, no problem. I guess I have one last question. Do you, like when you go from switch from real estate to Soho mode, do you like put that purple coat on that you have on now and like you change? Because well, people who are listening just on audio, they don't see it. Right now, Johnny's wearing this amazing shiny purple tuxedo coat. He's got a cane and a hat. I mean, he looks amazing. So I'd be remiss if I didn't address it. Like, does the switch turn on as soon as you put the coat on? Or do you lounge around and watch TV in that?
Listen, I think a lot, it was a slow evolution there. Okay. Like in the beginning, I would keep them separate and, you know, listen, I'm involved in real estate, but I'm not, you know, it's just, you know, kind of, it's now blending more and more in, because now if a retail is looking to open up in like in a difficult time for retailers all over, right? It was retail was having a hard time with Amazon before that pandemic, never mind post pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm more positioned to try to advise them and help them. We're bringing in more experiential effects, you know. At the end of the day, it's about getting people into the door for brick and mortar.
Right.
But I used to keep them more separated, not on purpose. It was just okay, because again, I was just Soho Johnny just kind of grew on its own, and now it's become a thing. So it's now they're kind of blending more and more together. The lines are blurring, so to speak. That's a great question. I'm thinking about it. And, you know, because now I'm trying to segue a lot of them together. I mean, listen, I could do gigs in my own places in a recording studio. I have an office in Greenwich, Connecticut. We're going to do a recording studio, and we're doing something actually in Soho in one of our places I've got in the works now. To have a studio and maybe somewhat of a club, but not like a big, loud, noisy club. It's going to be more like a membership. So we're working on something on that as well. But there's always going to be some philanthropy involved. There's always going to be something. It has to be connected that way, because I
love
think
it.
It's a, I just think it's almost like an obligation to do that. Okay. Because tomorrow it could be taken away like that for all of us. Right.
Yeah.
And I think absolutely. We have to keep our eye on the ball. And I don't get into religion. Okay. But I call this, I mean, we did a comic book called Mandate for Humanity, which is what we ended up calling the Soho Johnny. And, you know, it's just, you know, we have, that's a trip too, which, I'll mention that my friends ended up coming with the idea, and Eileen Shapiro and everybody, and my buddy Scott Page from Pink Floyd is.
Yeah, we had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. He's great.
Yeah, great guy.
I helped him, and he's a philanthropist. He did something great for the Watts Conservatory. I don't know if he mentioned it on the show.
Yep.
He did Dark Side of the NAM, because he's known for being part of Pink Floyd in the day, and I think Toto and Supertramp, whatever. But he's a great guy, and we collaborate. We're still collaborating on some things right now. But in the comic book, he's kind of like, I don't know if a lot of the listeners will remember Shazam. He's like a Superman type character. He
basically had a resurgence last year, power. Right?
He has all these bully bats, and he's just some kid, and he gets these powers from some amulet or something, and he has the powers from like Mercury for speed. I may get the names wrong, and someone else for super strength, all these like, you know, mythical gods. So they took that up in Soho Johnny through this world that has, it just became dead, void of entertainment, and everybody walks around humdrum. And Soho Johnny is a character that was inspired for Scott Page for something. Monty Rock III, which many people may remember, he was the DJ in Saturday Night Fever, and nice. He was very flamboyant. And Howard Bloom, which was a tremendous career he has as being a publicist to this day. And what he did. So
that's awesome.
Again, it's a lot of fun. I got to tell you guys, it's a lot of fun for the listeners.
So John is like the new Andrew Dice Clay, where you can't distinguish who's who.
I just imagine a scene early on where it's like he gets a call and they're like, there's a big question on the property. And you're like, listen, the jacket is on.
Yeah,
but they really know. I'm sorry. The jacket is on.
John, I want to thank you so much for your time, man, and have a great holiday season. Stay safe out there, and you're doing great work. So thank you so much for joining the show.
I appreciate that. But like everything else, my mentor, Stan Lee, he's in the back there with an autograph, bro. He was still alive. And his Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. So again, I encourage everybody tomorrow, wherever you are, when you start your day, put a smile on someone's face. And again, thank both of you for both having me today. and having the show now and keeping the light on, it's so important that we keep the spirits on, because we're going to get by this and we're going to overcome, as we all will.
Thanks so much, man. Awesome. Take care. All right, Mike, it's our time in the year is dwindling down. We're looking at the clock as we speak, and not much time left in Verbal Shenanigans 2020 year. I'm sorry, and this is the end of the podcast.
Yeah, it was a good run. I look forward to Scotty and Shay, the daddy son years of Verbal Shenanigans. Yep, you know, yep, I'll be the little cliff note after you take off, like, you know, all the big podcasts, and
yep.
I'll be there talking about, I had a good run. I got $2 on a stripper stage once, thanks to Verbal Shenanigans.
Yep.
Got a few lick cramps interviewing people at the Kilt Fest, but it's worth it, and I don't miss not having the millions that family has.
Yeah. Well, so let's get to the end here. What do you got?
Well, I have two little interesting stories from this Christmas week. I guess first off, when you celebrated Christmas, did you have any family over? Did you do like a call with people to see them on Christmas?
I saw my parents and my brother and sister. So,
okay.
We just went to... We didn't see any of the extended family at all like we would normally do, but, you know, it was nice. It was nice.
Yeah, so kind of like with Thanksgiving, I was the one in charge of setting up, like, a conference call for everybody to get on so Mom and Dad could see, like, all the kids and the grandkids and items like that.
Right.
And I did it for the Thanksgiving one, went through, not an issue, had... sister, brother, parents on there. Everything worked well. Scot-free, no issues. When it was all done the next day, my dad's like, son, thank you so much. You know, I really appreciate seeing the family send that up and all that. So, I'm in charge of the Christmas one.
Okay.
So first thought is, I'm just going to do the same damn thing I did the first time. Set it up on Facebook.
I hope this ends with, like, random guests from our show showing up at your family dinner.
Butterbean!
Victor Wooten, everybody. I mean, you're welcome to stay on, but...
Yeah. He's serenading us with his bass on Christmas, but I really wanted to talk to my uncle. I don't know. So, I'm setting it up, and I won't name the family member, but they're like... Oh, I want to get these people onto the call to see Mom and Dad and all, my mom and dad, I mean.
Yep.
But they don't have Facebook. So why don't we do a Zoom?
Okay.
And like, right off the bat, I'm like, you know, how hard is it to make a Facebook account to do this and close it out? You don't need to stick on. It's not like a license that you have to keep active or anything like that.
Right.
So, all right. Create the Zoom, send it out to everybody. Forgot to put the time on it, but I schedule it for 3:30. And then 2 days before the event, that same person comes back to me. Oh, what time is the Zoom meeting? I told everybody 5:00. So right off the bat, I'm like, well, why am I going to change it?
Right.
If you just, for no reason, announce to everybody, it's 5:00. Mm-hmm. All right. Fine, whatever. Change it over to 5. So we do the call, and I'm on there, and I got my cousins on there, my brother and sister, whatever. And we got, like, probably 10 people on there. And then... the constant question becomes, hey, where are your parents at? Hey, where are your parents at?
Okay.
And the first thing that happens is my dad, like, chimes in from the Facebook Messenger. I'm like, no, Dad, this is not how you do it. There's a link in Zoom.
Yeah.
Click on that. Then it tells me the browser won't work. Then it's, then it's him chiming in, trying to chime in on Facebook while everybody on the Zoom is chiming me saying, where's mom and dad? Where's mom and dad?
Right.
Then it's dad, go get your computer. Then it's, I don't know where it is. Then it's people dropping off as we're trying to make this happen. Then it's, he gets back on Facebook Messenger and I have to hold up the phone for him to see everybody there, which he can't hear them. But also the beautiful thing about this setup is if I put it low enough where they can see my parents see my living room wall. If I put it where he can see it, all they can see is the back end of my phone. So I've never been more flustered for 20 minutes on Christmas in my life, all because somebody goes, yeah, but they don't have Facebook.
So you're doing IT work, and then you're also doing teaching old people how to use the computer work.
Yeah, and that's what kind of hits my anxiety, because as people are going back and forth, I'm like, this is my day off. I'm not supposed to be doing IT work today. And it just drives me nuts. I'm like, I know what works for them. That's why we did it the last time. Why did you ask me to do this? And now, in the end, I'm the one that's like, I mean, obviously the parents are like, oh, thank you. You know, there's nothing you can do about that, blah, blah, blah. But like in the back of my head, I'm like, yes, there could have been something done. I could have told that person, shut up. I'm going to send you something. Take it or leave it.
More importantly, was your one-legged uncle on the call?
No, he's passed away for quite a while.
Oh.
Yes, my uncle Jimmy, who was known as the one-legged gay man, who turned into the no-legged gay man, who turned into now Christian no-legged gay man, into the late Uncle Jimmy.
The way you said he turned into, like, for my next trick, I will become the no-legged gay man.
Very wild kind of scene down there in North Brunswick, New Jersey. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, the magic's phenomenal. It's very artsy. Very artsy.
Very hipstery. Very hipster. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but I mean, that sounds about right. Like, my parents call me, like, twice a week, like, how do we get the Zoom on the thingy? I don't know how to set up a Zoom meeting. We're doing it with my aunts and uncles. I'm like, and I explain it, and then a lot of times it ends like, never mind, don't worry about it, whatever. Oh, yeah. You know, I'm like,
oh yeah, my favorite one is constantly them saying, tell them to download the app. I'm like, they can't figure out click the link. What are the odds on that working?
Yeah, no. Well, that sounds fun.
But another little interesting thing that came up this week is I'll kind of show him a little finger. You may remember this is the finger I talked about.
You may remember this finger from other podcasts, such as episode 392. all right, so we had that amazing delay problem where you just said Scotty, and it went Scotty, 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 and then you called me back, and it went Scotty, 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 Scotty. So, yeah. We'll go from there, Mike.
All right.
So you remember this finger from other episodes.
Yeah. Scotty and the finger. Exactly. But this is a finger I broke a while back, back in the IT flag football days. A buddy threw a pass, and first pass he ever threw to me in practice, broke my finger. But I was walking with the wife, and I'm like, you know, this finger's kind of plumped up recently, and it's been kind of thick and changing colors for like the last 3 days.
Wow.
So you got a little
infection in there?
Yeah, I guess I got like a skin infection in there, but you're kind of like me where like you don't go to the doctor a lot of periods, right?
pretty much period. I should go. You know, having a kid has kind of shifted my perspective on that a little bit, but I'm still like, next month. Next month will be the time I go for the full, you know, full body check.
Yeah, and then your wife's like, what about the dentist? It's like, whoa. One at a time.
Yeah,
come exactly. on.
Yeah.
But, so I had to, like, run around today, and, like, Georgia is not like Jersey. Like, Jersey if you wanted to go see a doctor, you pretty much call up and go, hey, you got an appointment? Yeah, come in. Okay. 90% of the time. Georgia, like, everything is like, well, if you're the first time with a doctor, you got to make an appointment like 4 months in advance before you can see them.
We got,
so I had to.
Ezekiel will see you, though. He's dealt with fingers before.
So I had to, like, go around Georgia for minute clinics to try to, the little clinics that are in, like, CVS's and Walgreens and stuff like that. I had to search around for an hour to find one to finally get a lady. And I've spent $100 on this finger today, this little fingertip. So now I'm on antibiotics and using creams and wasted my last day off of the year to save my little fingertip.
So now I have had something very similar to that before. Is your, does your finger like hurt to press anything? Like it's very like
I won't say there's pain. It's weird. Like if I grab it like this on the sides, it's like a little pins and needles on this end, but like actually using it, I have no issues, no pain whatsoever. And
I've had
kind of figured it was like a circulation thing, but like after like 3 days of it. And again, since I basically didn't think I broke the finger that day and I just let it be. And then like a month later, I'm like, oh, that ain't right. Having that extra knuckle there, but
see, I've had where like, I think like I didn't cut a nail properly and there's like a hangnail on the side and it gets all red and kind of infected. And then I've just squeezed the hell out of it and like this green crap comes flying out. And I'm like, that feels better. And then usually it would take like one, two of those, like over the next 2 days where I squeeze it again and it kind of goes away. So I don't know if it's the same thing, but it looks, you know, I'm looking at you through a computer screen. It looks kind of similar to that. You do have a nice big finger.
Equivalent. Yeah.
You got like an ET finger going on.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, with the crookedness, it kind of works out. If I can figure out a way to put like a light on there, I mean, maybe I can make some money. I don't know.
You know what? But this is a perfect opportunity. Like, there's so many cool, like, new appendages you can get. You can probably get like a great carbon fiber finger that's like will never go wrong. It's probably got like, you could have like a USB charger in it, maybe a hotspot.
Ooh. I don't mind. Like, kind of like an Inspector Gadget. Mm-hmm. You know, like where, like I wanted the fingertip, but if like somebody's like, I need a light, it'll just flip up and I can shoot a flame out.
So what did they say it was?
Well, she assumes obviously it's a skin infection, but like she looked at it closely and she couldn't even find like a piercing or a hole where she could see where it started from. So like I'm on antibiotics for like a week because of my fingertip.
Was she like, please drop your pants? Ma'am, it's my finger.
Well, yeah, I'm going to tell you where to stick the finger. I don't want to touch that thing.
I can't wait till we record next week and you're like, you just have like a claw. Things didn't. Berla, what do you got? Well, I have a little story. Ka-chink!
Ka-chink! Berla, is that a Concord grape at the end of your hand? No, it's still my finger. I ain't going back. I ain't spending another $100 on this thing.
Yeah. It's weird, man. Like, I feel like, you know, getting old. Like, I remember my dad just like, we took a vacation down in North Carolina. I remember his elbow just was swelling up like the size of a grapefruit. And I remember him just being like miserable pain, hanging his elbow out the window on the drive all the way to North Carolina and like him soaking his elbow in Epsom salt just so he can like be on vacation. It's just like weird, like getting older, like random things would just be like, I'm going to explode right now and just get real. There's like no like actual cause. There's not like, oh, I hurt that finger. I did that. I hit my elbow on something. He just randomly had an explosive elbow.
It was it like waddling in the wind and all like going back and forth like it was like a tennis ball.
It was so big and red and gross. When we were down there, I remember he went and got it drained. Like they were like, oh, we got to drain that thing. It's like, it was disgusting. It's just got like a big pussy bubble.
Like, he's like, no, no problem. I got this. And he got like a cane opener, open it up. And he's like, hey, kid. Ah, oh, dad.
It is funny. It is funny, though, because I'll be the first person, like, if the wife is not feeling, I'm like, oh, you should go to the doctor. Like, you know, that's what we pay insurance for, blah, blah, blah. And then when it comes to me, I'm like, I'll be okay. I'll give it a couple of days. That's always my line. I'll give it a couple of days.
There's a lump on your throat. Yeah, but it's only been there for like 2 days. I mean, a week, then we should be talking.
It's definitely why men die earlier. We're just stubborn.
Oh, yeah.
We're stubborn and like, we'll be okay. I'm okay. I've gotten through other things before, you know?
Yeah, you know men invented, just throw a leech on it. There's no woman that was like, you know, I'm having these pains and we'll just put a leech right on there and you'll be fine. A man's like, yeah, this thing will suck it out.
Like, this is what's in there. This is how neurotic I am. Like, what age are you supposed to go, like, get a colonoscopy? Is it 40?
If it's 40, I'm late.
Yeah, why am I asking you?
I don't know. 80? That seems about right.
Well, it's funny because something goes wrong. Yeah, I'm like already I've already consciously thought about, oh man, that's like coming up soon for me. I'm probably not going to do that. Like, I'm probably not going to go do that.
Yeah, that's one of the things, like, you're even afraid to ask because it's like, you mean you haven't had one? No, I've had plenty. But
you've had plenty?
All the time. Like, last weekend, I'm like, yeah, fill it up. But
you've had plenty? Yeah, that's a little weird. I'm curious
what the average age is because I've probably been doing it way earlier than the real number is why I'm asking you, nurse.
We should go get colonoscopies together so we can compare. Ooh. Our... We could have a story for the podcast. That's basically what we should do.
We should have a Zoom meeting where we just have the camera go up there. And it's like, Scott, that's interesting. Tell us a little bit about that. Funny story, Berlew.
Yeah, but our Zoom cameras are also the cameras that they're using to go up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's going to be our animation when we start our YouTube channel. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, I'm so bad with that, man. I went to the dentist for the first time in a long time, whatever, right before my wedding. So that was almost 2 years ago. And I was like panicking over it. And it went okay. I still had to have some cavities drilled or whatever. And I got that drill stuck in my tongue, if you remember that story. Mm-hmm. So needless to say, I haven't been back since. So now we're talking. I'm starting to rack up the years again. We're almost on year two. You know, it's like, I don't know what it is. It's stupid. It really is stupid because 90% of the time you go and everything's fine. But it's always like, but what if it's not fine?
Hmm.
What if I'm dying? You know? Like, I don't know if I just don't want to know. Like, I sometimes I'm like, well, I don't want to know. I'll just die. It's fine.
It's kind of funny. It's like, even like when I go to a doctor, I don't even when Izzy came with me and it was, they're like, oh yeah, you have any family history or anything? Nope. And she's like, well, doesn't your dad have like skin cancer? Oh yeah, cancer. Doesn't your uncle have dementia? Oh yeah, check that one up too.
Did
yeah,
your other uncle lose his leg? No.
Yeah. Oh yeah, diabetes. So oh yeah, I think I got high blood pressure. I don't know. You want to check that out for me?
Yeah, throw man. I am not good at that. Like, I had terrible experiences with dentists as a kid. Not like a touchy feely dentist, but like I broke my teeth so many times. I hated my dentist, so I wrote them off early in life. And then I don't know, man. I just, as I got older, I was just like, I don't want to go to the doctor. And then I kind of like built it up in my head. Now I'm like, I don't know, man. I just had a kid. I should probably go to the doctor. God forbid something's wrong. But now I'm like, maybe when he turns 3. Yeah. You know, it's just
like you bring the kid into the baby doctor and you're like, how's the baby doing? Well, let's say hypothetically the baby has a burning sensation when it pees. Just hypothetically. I wouldn't know. But right. What would you throw to said child?
Yeah. How's the baby been doing? Well, his back hurts every time he lays down and he's out of breath going up the stairs. Going up the stairs. He can't walk.
He lifts weights. But he's too. Yeah, I mean, he writes it up. He's got a good, like, muscle tone.
That's funny you said that. We just went to the doctor today. He just got shots. Like, that was interesting. He's got some vaccines, you know.
Oh, you're listening to them. Good job.
Yeah, you know, as much as I want to, like, be like, oh, my kid dodged polio when he gets older, like, yeah, he did it. I proved you wrong. You know, yeah, it was weird, man. It's a really, really bizarre experience. Like, I don't know. You hear people talk about, like, oh, I remember taking my kids to get shots. It was this. But, like, I don't know. It was kind of a champ, man. But it's so weird to see your kid get, like, needles put in them. And you start to think, like, oh, I hope they don't have any reaction to this and blah, blah, blah. I'm sitting there nervous for him at the doctor. I'm like sweaty and kind of like, oh man, this sucks. I know what's coming. And that's the way I am when I get like shots. I'm like, I know what's coming. Like I had to get blood work done and another shot or something when Alex was pregnant to figure out our blood types and this and that. And if our blood types don't match, the mom's got to get like a shot to make sure the blood types don't affect each other or whatever the hell it is. And I'm the same way for my son. I'm getting worse, I think, as I get older.
Maybe you should just ask the doctor, hey, can you hand me one of those? I'm not sure what I got. You know, yeah. It's been 12 years. I might have polio. Who knows? Smallpox? It seems about right.
Yeah. Did you have chicken pox as a kid?
That is a weird thing. Like, I never remember.
I had HIV.
Like, I don't think I've had it. And, like, my mom kind of says, I think you've had it. I'm like, okay, when did I have it? And she has no idea. So I'm in that weird area where it's like, I can't, like, not that I'd be hanging around with a bunch of kids with chicken pox, but at the same time, it's like, I gotta have that caution of assuming I may have never had it.
Yeah, I had it. I remember my brother having it really bad. He got like in his ear, and like I remember he's like making his communion or something like that. And he was like miserable and crying all day. I remember I had it. I remember like moms back in the day would be like, "Oh, you had chicken pox? Like, oh, our kids should hang out." So you just get it and it's done with. It's funny because chicken pox, like I brought it up to kids before, and they just look at you like, that's not a thing anymore. Like, kids don't get chicken pox anymore.
Really?
Yeah, you get vaccinated for it.
I've heard of smallpox, but I didn't know, like, chicken pox was the vaccination thing.
Never. Kids never get it anymore. It's weird. I just remember being like, oh, Scott. You know, like, Jimmy got chicken pox. Ah, he'll be out of school for a week, you know?
No. See, we're bringing, after calorie day, we're going to need a second promotion. I'm thinking, like, so, like, calorie day is like our summer thing because, you know, everybody's going to have their shirts off. They're going to have barbecue, all that stuff. When we get into fall, kind of calm things down, we still want something, like, kind of ruckus, and then we'll have chicken pox football where, like, everybody goes out and plays flag football. But the key thing is we have to have teammates with chicken pox.
So you can get QB sacked. You can get sacked, or you can get a disease. Like it's a question. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. We're all gonna get the herd immunity. It's gonna be great. I mean, some of us older people might get sterile, but that's fine. As long as we come together as a community, play some flag football, the fall activity tradition. See, now we got two seasons done. We only had to figure out winter and spring.
I'm thinking what we're gonna do. Instead of chicken pox football, which is a great idea, why don't we do a campaign like, you know, kids aren't as tough as they used to be. Bring back the pox, you know, bring Ooh. Back the pox, bring back where we
BBP.
You know, we go to places like playgrounds and elementary schools with our little lemonade stand. It's kind of like a lemonade stand, but it's just chicken pox infested drinks. And we're just like,
oh,
yeah, you know, your kid's getting soft. He's never had the chicken pox. Why don't you give him this pox lemonade? And, you know, he becomes a man.
Or hear me out. Instead of doing, we'll label it as lemonade, but it'll be our new kind of hidden camera punked. Instead of punked, it's poxed.
You got poxed.
But my husband, he's very fragile, his immune system. Well, he should have thought that before he got poxed.
Yeah, we're bringing back the good diseases, the ones, the old time diseases that you all got, you know?
Yeah, old school. When I get older, I want them shingles so I can think back to the great memories of getting poxed.
I agree. But, all right, so we learned a lot today. We learned that Calorie Day is probably the next big American holiday. We learned that Mike's got a ET finger, and he's not going to go to the doctor to see it. So Mike may have some kind of, like, Wolverine-type hand next week, which will be interesting to hear about. Mike will, he's volunteering his services to guide your family Zoom calls. And we learned that if you didn't have chicken pox, you're a bitch. So, Mike, let's get the hell out of here. Last episode of the year. Next week's a big one. Anything to promote before we go?
It's not technically a promotion, but I'll throw out there is what we went through in 2020 and like all the struggling that some businesses have gone through. I'd like to ask everybody to go out.
What happened in 2020? Please start from the beginning. Go.
Okay, well, it was January 1st. Around March, some people got sick, and then we all went inside, and that was December. So,
kind of accurate. But, yep.
But I'd like to ask people to go out there and support your local restaurants, breweries, or whatever. Kind of what made me do this today, one of the places I promoted here once before, Leprechauno Meadery, they unfortunately had their end-of-line sale today. I went out there to support them. It's just one of those with nothing really chugging in 2020. They couldn't get, like, footwork out there. It was just a decision they had to do to, like, bring it down. The owners were so nice. I bought a couple bottles. They threw in a couple bottles and swag with it and all. So I was very appreciative. So, you know, whatever your local stuff, like, I'll say Tap House 15, where Scott, hopefully soon, Verbal Shenanigans Comedy Shows come back to. Mansker Brewery, who's been a former supporter of ours. A former guest of ours, the Nappy Roots, they're going to start their brewery in 2021. Atlanta Tucky, looking forward to being out there and supporting them there. Just go out where you can. If you're scared to go out, you know, get takeout. Find a way to help these people. A lot of people are hurting. If you got a few extra bucks, share the wealth, if you will.
Yeah. I'm kind of in a similar vein. Future guest of the show, there's a brewery up in the Adirondacks where I vacation, right in Glens Falls, called Common Roots Brewery. And the only reason I'm promoting them is because I had a bunch of their beers over Christmas vacation, if you will. And I really enjoy the beer. I've always enjoyed going there and stopping in. They're a small business. They just opened a new brewery because the other one burned down. And I'm sure we'll get to that in our interview in a couple weeks. And they're just one of my favorite breweries going. I really do enjoy their stuff. So if you're into craft beer, good beer, check out Common Roots Brewery in Glens Falls, New York. That's it for us. It's been one hell of a year. Not even a question as far as guest-wise, our best year.
Easily.
We'll be posting who we have on, who we had on, and some of our favorites, and a couple things like that. But please go check out the past episodes. There's so many really, really great guests. At one point, we were getting like two great guests a week and putting out two episodes a week, and it was almost like a point where we couldn't even manage how many cool people we were getting on. But as 2021, we're rolling into it. We already have all of January booked. We are getting very close to getting one of my, I don't want to jinx it,
Mount Rushmore.
One of my Mount Rushmore guests when we started this show. It's not Sean Kemp. We'll get that bastard on soon. But we're getting close, and hopefully that comes to fruition. But we got some really cool guests coming up. And thank you for your support over the years and your listenership. Please share the podcast. That's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
E.T. go home.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where those treetops listen and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow, the snow. So then I am dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write. May your days, may your days be merry and bright. And may all your Christmases be white. Christmas Eve.